catch up with it. My name is Brenda. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, thank you for that. I really do. This is sort of a bittersweet night for me because this will be the last time I'll be speaking in Florida. I'll be moving in the middle of the week, and this is going to be one of my last meetings. I need to share what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. My freedom day is May the 13th, 1997. And I say freedom because it was my freedom from the bondage of alcohol. And that's just the truth for me. My childhood was pretty basic, you know. I had a Leave It to Beaver childhood. I had two parents that stayed together, never divorced. I never had any major upsets in my life other than the fact that my dad was in the Army, so I was always the new kid on the block because he kept getting transferred. When we finally got to Nashville, Tennessee, we got to stay put for a while. And I was always kind of shy because going out and meeting kids was kind of hard for me. So when I found out at the age of 16 what alcohol could do, it took away the shyness, it made me cute, it made me popular, it did all that. I just followed through with the alcohol. I just kept drinking. So from the time I was 16, I was off and running. I started hanging out with kids that were drinkers like that. I started smoking cigarettes, started skipping school. My senior year, I don't know how I graduated because I think I missed more than I went. And I never made it to first class during the daytime because we couldn't get there in time. We had to stop and figure out what we were going to do, pool our money, get gas, buy cigarettes, and figure out where we was going to go find a drink when we skipped out at fourth period. And that was just the way the school year went. Graduation night, I was allowed to stay out a little bit later, which was midnight. And my parents asked me what time I needed to come in, and I said, well, it's really, really a special night. I need to stay out later. And my dad said, what time? And I said, how about 2 o'clock? And he said, okay. So we went out to stay out at 2 o'clock. We took a couple of cases of beer and went down to the rock quarry, about 25 or 30 of us, and I wound up wrecking my car. I knocked a hole in the gas tank. So we had to push that car, and I parked it in front of the house so they wouldn't know, and I got in without them finding out. And, of course, the next day we had to push it to a gas station so that I could try to get it fixed. And my dad found out about it. And, of course, that was my first time that I got grounded for alcohol. And it proceeded, it just followed me after that. I started into college that year. My very first night at college, we took off and had a car wreck, and we're drunk. I was late getting back to school. My parents got called. I had to come all the way to Murfreesboro from Nashville. And it just so happened that the dean of college was my geometry teacher from high school. So she just looked at me and shook her head. Now she says, I got you again, right? I'm like, yes, you got me again. So naturally, I only made it one semester through college. I got through that one semester, and I didn't go back. It was too hard. They expected me to work, and I wasn't going to work. So I got a job, and I started living what I thought was going to be the high life. I still was at 18 years old, because I graduated from high school right before I turned 17. So I still was at 18 years old, and I couldn't move out, which is what I wanted to do. All I wanted to do was move out. Mom and Dad were strict. They expected me to follow rules, and I didn't want to do it. So I moved out on my 18th birthday, and my father was standing there the next – well, no, let me take that back. It's 2 weeks before my 18th birthday because I got my first paycheck, and I decided that I was grown, and I went in, packed my stuff, and moved out. And my father was at my apartment the next morning with two policemen. I wasn't 18. I was going home. So I had to go back home for that 2 weeks. And in that time, I was still doing my running around, still drinking and getting in all kinds of trouble. Well, I decided that it would be easier to be married than it would be to go back into that. So I got married. I was barely 18. He was 24. And we proceeded to move to Chattanooga, Tennessee and start married bliss. I was going to have the house with a little picket fence, We were going to have 2.2 kids. We was going to have a dog. We were going to do all that good stuff. And I was pregnant right off the bat. So what happened was I'm sitting at home. He's out drinking. And that's when I first got the idea that the girlfriends had more fun. Wives got the boredom. Wives got to sit home. Wives got to keep the house clean. And the husbands got to go have all the fun. Well, I wound up leaving when I was 7 months pregnant because he was taking some other girl around, introducing her as his wife. And I'm sitting at home like this. I wasn't real happy. So my parents came and got me. I was an only child, so they really, really enabled me a lot. And I went home. I got a divorce when she was like a month old. I got married again when she was 6 weeks old. And he was 24. And I was 19. So that one, yeah, I figured that, you know, I learned my lesson the first time I was married. I wanted to be the one to go drink. I wanted to be the one to have fun. So the gentleman that I married didn't drink. He was in the Air Force. He would fly out of town, and I would hit the roads. And I would go drink with my girlfriends. Well, you know what? You don't go out drinking like the way I did and not find a boyfriend. Or two. Or three. Yeah. This is just my life. You know, I would go drinking. And because when I was drinking, a lot of things would happen. And I found out the girlfriend had more fun. You know, I was the wife. I had the husband to pay the bills. He took care of all that stuff. But I was also the girlfriend. I got to have the fun. And that was what I thought it boiled down to. So he didn't like that idea. For some reason, he just really thought that I shouldn't be out with other guys. So we didn't stay together. We got a divorce. And then I had met this other guy that I was seeing while I was married to him. He was in the Navy. And he was 24. And he actually came over. My second husband actually came over to meet this guy and tell him to do good by me because he really cared and didn't want to see me getting in trouble. So here my second husband passed me off to my third husband. And my third husband decided that he wanted to move to Atlanta, Georgia and work there. And I was pregnant. And my second child was born when we moved to Atlanta. Now, I stayed married to him for quite a few years. I didn't live with him quite a few years. I just stayed married to him quite a few years. Because when I got to Atlanta, I found other substances as well as alcohol. And I was really off and running. You know, I found out that alcohol would get me where I wanted to go, but I could get there quicker with this other stuff. And this other stuff that they had, I could do, could let me drink longer and more for a while. You know, I could just keep going. And I started doing that. And for some reason, the law didn't like it too much. They would get a little ticked off at me. And I got where I was playing Weekend Warrior every weekend. You know, I would wind up in jail every weekend for something. You know, one night it would be I hit a cop. Next night it would be because I did a U-turn in the middle of the street. You know, and I'd get into a fight and it'd show up at my door. You know, something would happen every weekend and I would wind up there. And it seems that I had lessons all along. When I would go to jail in DeKalb County, there was a gentleman there that we called Donald Duck, and he was always on the runaround. And he would see me come in, and he'd have my coffee made just the way I liked it and hand it to me in the holding cell. So when I got to that holding cell on Friday night or Saturday night, I expected my coffee. And this went on for a while. And finally, after about a year, I went in one night, and this time I was going in for a little bit longer than a weekend. And I got caught in a few other things that they weren't real happy with. And when I got there, I asked for Donald because my coffee wasn't there. And they had informed me that Donald had died. Now, Donald was the resident alcoholic. He would get out. He would be out 24 hours and be right back in. He did not stay sober unless he was locked up. Now, neither did I, but I didn't place myself in the same category as him. You know, he was old, and he looked like an alcoholic. You know, I didn't look like an alcoholic. Therefore, I couldn't be an alcoholic. I was a girl for one thing, and I was young for another thing, and it just wasn't going to work out that way. And I felt really sad when I heard about that. Well, the judges in that county got tired of putting up with me, and this last charge I got was a little bit stiffer. And they managed to tell me I was going to be going down to Hardwick, which is Georgia Women's Correctional Institute, for a little while. And they said, well, first of all, in that particular case, they gave me a 5-year probation, and they jerked my probation in another county, and that's the one that decided to send me to Harvard. So like I said, I cleaned up well, and I could go up in front of the judge, and I got away with a lot because of that. I would look like the one that never got into trouble. I was always the one that other people led into trouble, and I was usually the one that started it. And so when I went down to Harvard, I did what I was supposed to do there, and I came back up to Atlanta, up to a women's halfway house there. And I was in the halfway house for a while. And when I got out of the halfway house, I got out at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I was drunk by noon, and I had a needle in my arm by 6 o'clock that night. That's how much good jail did me, because I was not ready to tell anybody that I could not run my life. So when I got out, my third husband was still married to me. He just didn't live with me. And then finally I said, well, you know, we might as well go ahead and get a divorce. That way I can get some money out of it, right? You know, I can get the child support, and I can get the alimony, and you know, interest in the house, you know, all this stuff. So we went ahead and got a divorce. And I married my next husband. I think I was about 34, 35, and he was 24. And this was the one that was going to solve all my problems, you know? So it was still more fun to be the girlfriend than it was to be the wife. So he had a good job, so I allowed him to pay the bills. And I kept going and finding a boyfriend. I kept drinking, and I kept doing the things that I was doing. And this went on for a while. And after I got out, my children had gone to live with my parents while I was in prison. And when I got out, I was given a certain amount of time to get my children back. And I never could find the time away from alcohol to go get my kids back. I never could find the time to leave alcohol alone enough to build a life to go get my children back. And as for the other stuff, I quit doing that when I got out of prison. Now, this is one part I do have to stop and make an amends to anybody that's ever heard my story before, because I say I did not do any drugs after I got out, and after I got through that first couple of weeks of getting high when I first got out. I did do drugs after I got out. I just quit paying for them. Now, if you don't pay for them, people eventually quit giving them to you. So I did quit. You know, and but I kept drinking, and my drinking just tripled. I never took a drug in my life that didn't start out with a drink first. I have never started out with a drug and gone to a drink. I've always started with a drink and gone to a drug. And this was where I understood, after I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, that I was a drug abuser. I was a horrible drug abuser, but I was not a drug addict. I am definitely an alcoholic, because when it came time to stop the drugs, I was able to stop the drugs. I could not stop drinking. Alcohol was there. It had to be there. If it wasn't there, I don't know. I would have probably killed myself, because I could not face life in any way, shape, or form. Well, anyway, what happened was I decided this fourth husband wasn't doing me any good, and I had to get out of town. So I filed for divorce. I had some dirt on him, and I threatened to turn him into the police if he didn't sign the divorce papers. We signed the divorce papers on Thursday morning at 10:30, and I packed up and headed to Florida the next day. And I got to Florida, and I came down working with the Waffle House, and I was manager. And what I did was I got here, met a guy that worked at the Waffle House, and I was 44. He was 24 when we got married. He just, you know, this is funny to me now. But when I stop and I look back, what happened was when I started drinking, I quit growing emotionally. When I started drinking, I did not gain any maturity. I gained no life skills. I had nothing. So naturally, I'm going to stay in the same place. And you know what? If I can find a 24-year-old sick enough to marry me at that age, then honey, he is just one sick puppy, let me tell you. And we got together. We got along great. You know, we really did. This one, I was with him for almost 10 years. And we went through a lot of geographicals, because he was drinking just like I was. And he was sneaking around and doing drugs, because by that time I decided I wouldn't have anything to do with drugs, even if they brought it to me free. And I would catch him, and we would fight, you know, and then he would promise he wasn't going to do it anymore. We'd just drink, you know. We went this way. We moved to California, and we took ourselves with us. We moved back from California, and we came back. My mom got cancer, and we decided to move up to Atlanta, Georgia, to be close to her. And so we packed up and left Florida again, and we got to Atlanta. And my mom passed away on May the 13th, 1995. Now, my mom never saw me sober. I was still very drunk. And the night my mom died, my dad called me 2 o'clock in the morning and said, "We just lost your mom." And I was drunk. He says, "You need to come now." And I knew I couldn't drive. Well, my husband drove us, and he wasn't in too much better shape than I was, but at least he wasn't crying. And we got up to North Carolina, where my dad and my mom lived, and I got through that funeral. When my dad came out to the car to hold me, I know all he smelled was alcohol. But he never said a word. He never said a word. And I didn't drink the days that we were there for that funeral. And by the time we left to go back to Atlanta, I was shaking so bad. My mom and dad live in a dry county. By the time we got out of that county, it's like, find the first 7-Eleven, do whatever you got to do, get me a six-pack. I need a six-pack. So I got that six-pack, and we headed back to Atlanta. Well, the purpose of us moving to Atlanta was to be close enough to get to my mom. She was gone. So we felt like we were free to go wherever. We moved to Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. We worked there until it got cold, and we came back to Florida. And things were really going bad between us at that point in time. And I don't know what happened. After my mom died, I could never really drink comfortably. You know, every time I would drink, I would start a fight with my husband. I would do something. I was never comfortable with drinking again. And then on May the 5th, 1997, we went to the Cinco de Mayo celebration. And we got into a really big fight when we got home. And he walked out. Now, about a month before he left that time, he had stood on the stairs. I used to come in, I would start drinking every night. And I would usually pick a fight with him, because if I could get him mad enough, he'd go to bed and leave me alone so I could drink. So that night he was going up the stairs and he looked at me and he goes, Brenda, we've been together 10 years and you've never told me you were sorry. You have never told me you were sorry. And I'm thinking, I remember sitting on the couch, and this is like yesterday, I can remember saying, that might be true. I've never said I'm sorry. But you've always done worse things than me, so I don't have to say I'm sorry. You know, that's what I'm saying in my head. And he would go to bed, and I would have this big fight with him in my head, and then the next day I'd be mad because he don't remember what I said, and I said some good stuff. I really did. And so, anyway, when we got into that fight, he left on May the 5th, 1997. I pulled all the shades in my house. I locked the doors. I quit answering the phone. It would ring. I'd hear the messages, and I wouldn't pick the phone up. And I did that. I would go out every day, and I'd get more beer. I would go to Blockbuster and get three movies. And I would go home, and I'd put a movie on, and I'd start drinking. I didn't eat. I forgot what food was. I could not tell you one thing about those movies. I remember getting that one movie, Air Jordan, Michael Jordan basketball. I still don't know what happened in that movie, along with all the rest of them. But that's the only one that I remember renting in that time, because I really wanted to see that before, you know. And I do know that on May the 13th, I woke up from the pass out that I'd had from the night before. It was about 3 or 4 in the morning when I passed out. I woke up about 1 o'clock. I was still on the couch. By that time, I'd already quit sleeping in the bed, and I slept on the couch every night. And I stood up in the middle of my living room, and I said, God, help me. And I didn't tell God what to do. You know, for years, every time I get drunk, every time things went wrong, every time I didn't get my way, I would start praying and telling God what he needed to do to get me out of, fix, give to me, or something. You know, I always knew what he needed to do to make things right, the way I wanted them to be. But that day I just stood there and said, God, help me, because I did not know what to tell him to do, because I didn't know. I didn't have a clue. And for some reason, I picked the phone up, and I started calling all these hospitals around. And I had an insurance card. I had two of them. I had one for my job and one for my husband's job. And I couldn't read those insurance cards to let the hospital know that I did have insurance, that I needed to get in, I needed to be treated. And the last number I came to in the phone book was Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I didn't know anything about Alcoholics Anonymous. To me, it was all a bunch of old men that sat around in trench coats, and they'd sit under a bridge and they'd get drunk, and girls would go by and they'd flash them. And that's what I thought. That's what I truly thought alcoholics were. Nobody was an alcoholic under the age of 60. That was just a given, you know, in my head. And that was the only number left in the book. I called all the hospitals that was in that book. I called the detoxes that was in that book, and all of them told me they couldn't help me. So when I got the Alcoholics Anonymous hotline, I got this lady, and she had this little perky girl voice, you know, and I thought, she's doing community service. And I said, well, you know, I really don't know how you can help me. You know, I was terminally unique. And She said, I'll tell you. She says, I'm 45 years old. I drank for 23 years, and I've been sober for 5. Now, what's your problem? And I thought, well, maybe she can help me, you know. So I started talking to her, and I was on the phone with her for about an hour. And What happened was she told me that I needed to go down to this place called the West Side Club. She told me where it was. She told me how to get there. She talked about her drinking and what she did and what happened to her when she went through the sobering up process. And she also told me that it might be 2 o'clock in the afternoon, but I need to go down there right now. Because if I waited to 5:30, I'd probably be drinking. And she was right. I was already planning on walking to that refrigerator, picking up the beer. Now, so if I'd waited, I would have. I got in my car, and I drove to the West Side Club, and I went in, and there was only 2 people there. They had a couch in the front room at the time, and there was this little guy laying on the couch, and I walk in the door, and he looks up, and he goes, "Oh, hi, how are you?" And I said, "I'm fine." And he says, "Go on back." So I walk to the back room, and there's this counter there, and there's this old white-haired guy behind the counter. And I kind of walked in. I was lost. I didn't know what to think, what to say, anything. I was just scared to death. And he looked at me and he goes, "You knew?" Oh, how's he know? You know? And I said, "Yes." And he says, "Well, sit down here." And he points to a stool. And I sat down in the stool because I didn't know what else to do. He ordered me and I did it. So he says, "You want a cup of coffee?" And I don't drink coffee. And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Okay." And he just stood there for a little bit and kind of went around talking about some other stuff. The other guy came back and they talked. And the other guy bought an acceptance pamphlet. I don't think they print them anymore. But they bought this little 50-cent acceptance pamphlet. And he hands it to me and he says, "If you read that and understand it, you're going to be okay." Well, you know, I started trying to read it and I couldn't even read it. But I was just standing there. My hands were shaking. I didn't know what to do. So I sat there and I waited. And you know, that is the longest couple hours I have ever sat in my life. But I waited till that 5:30 meeting came. And I went in and I sat down at that 5:30 meeting. And I sat in the back of the room, just like any good new alcoholic would do. I sat there and I held my head down. And the room was full. And there was a guy at the podium. And he kept calling on people like we did here. And they would read these things that they read here. And I didn't know what they were talking about. Then they started the meeting, and it was a discussion meeting, and they were saying words like sponsors, steps, and all this kind of stuff, and I had no clue what they were talking about. And I'm sitting there like this, you know, my head down, and all I can think of is it only lasts an hour. I can go get a beer and get the hell out of here. That was all I was thinking. So at the end of the meeting, I stood up, and then all of a sudden, this girl that had been sitting across from me grabs my hand, and they start praying. I'm like, "Oh, Lord, am I in the wrong place?" You know. And so when it was over, you know, I reach over, I get my purse. You know, I carried this huge purse at the time because I had so much important stuff. And I threw it over my shoulder, and she grabbed me, and she goes, "You know what? You look like you need to talk." And in my head, I'm going, "No, I need a beer." And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, come over here and talk to me. I've got some friends that will join us." And I'm like, "I just want to leave." And I said, "Okay." And I walked over and I sat down. So 2 other girls came over and sat with her. And she asked me a few questions. She said, "Is this your first time here?" I said, "Yes." She said, "When's the last time you had a drink?" And I said, "It was about 3 o'clock yesterday morning." And she said, "You're not looking too good. You're starting to shake a little bit." And I said, "Well, I'm scared. That's the reason I'm scared." And she said, "How long has it been since you ate?" And, you know, I could not remember the last meal I had. I could not remember the last time I put solid food in my mouth. So she said, "We're going to take you to eat." So they got me in the car, and they took me down to Sonny's restaurant. They bought me something to eat, and I took one bite, and I thought it was going to come right back up. So I just sat there while they ate. And she says, "Don't worry, we'll pack it up and you can take it home and eat it later." And I'm like, "Yeah, right." So I sat there and I'm listening to them talk, and I'll never forget it. I'm listening to them talk, and they're laughing and they're joking and they're kidding around with each other, and they're not drinking. How do they do that? It'd been so long since I've had a conversation with anybody without alcohol in my system that I just couldn't fathom it. I just couldn't see it happen. Anytime that I went to work, I still had alcohol in my system from the night before. And then when I got off from work, man, that's when I loaded up for the next day. And, I mean, I was always with alcohol in my system 24/7. And it had been that way for the last 20 years of my drinking. So I just didn't understand it. And we got back to the club and picked my car up, and they let me out of the car. And I said, "Thank you," and I head to my car, "I'm leaving." And this little blonde, again, grabs me by the arm, and she goes, I think we need to come to your house with you. And I'm like, what for? You know, and I said, okay. We get to my apartment, we walk in the front door, and I've got these three girls that I do not know following me in my house. One of them is in my kitchen, the other one went straight to my bedroom, the other one's sitting on my telephone going, let me see your insurance cards. And the one in the kitchen's going, so you don't care if I pour this out, do you? You know, by that time it's already halfway down the drain. My $65 bottle of wine is down the drain, you know. And I'm just sitting on the couch watching this, and I don't understand what's going on, and I'm really starting to shake, and I was feeling so bad. And the girl on the phone says, okay, she said, we found your place to go. They'll accept your insurance cards. And the girl in the kitchen walked back out, and she goes, well, there's no more booze in the house, so when you come home, you'll be okay. And the other one upstairs in my bedroom comes down and says, I have your bag packed. And I'm in the car going to D-Tag. And I get to this place, and they stay with me. They stayed with me. They got me checked in. And you couldn't smoke inside, but they had a smoking area. And I smoked at the time, and I was just like chain puffing. And I didn't want them to go. I was scared, and they stuck around. And one of them got to stay inside with me, and the other two had to wait outside. And it was like 6 o'clock in the morning before they finally was able to get me to let go of them so they could leave me there. And they had to all work that next day. They, you know, like they left me like 6 in the morning. And they all had to be at work between 7 and 9. They didn't sleep all night. They stayed up to help me. And not only did they stay up with me that night, they got the keys to my apartment so they could go take care of my animals. They were willing to do that for me. And I couldn't figure out why. I didn't know why. So I was already starting to detox, and I had to be checked by a doctor, and they did all this, and the doctor informed me. He says, we're going to have to medicate you pretty heavy. He says, do you know that you can die when you detox from alcohol if you have enough alcohol in your system over a long period of time? And I didn't know that. I knew I could shake. I knew that I could get pretty sick, but I didn't know that I could die. And I was over 200 pounds, and it was not a healthy weight at all. And I was really, really sick. And so they kind of knocked me out. The first 24 hours I just slept. And then they started moving me around a little bit and pulling me away from the medication. So about the fourth day I was able to say hello to people, you know, and come back around. And so by the time I checked out of there, they wanted to keep me on a long-term program. Well, I couldn't do that because I was going to lose my house, my car, my animals. There was no way. And I knew that if I went back out and drank again, that I would lose everything. I also knew that if I didn't go then, I would lose everything. So they wanted to sign me up on this two times a week deal and come back, and it would cost me $25 per session. My insurance would pay the rest. And that was going to be $50 a week, which is $200 a month, and I couldn't do that either. And the psychiatrist looks at me and she goes, well, what do you plan to have as your follow-up care? And I said, I'm going to AA. And she goes, you might need a little more than that. And I said, well, if I do, I'll call you. You know? And so they had told me in the meetings that I went to in there that my biggest chance for success was that the quicker I got to a meeting when I left there, the better chance I had of not picking up a drink. So I left there at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I was at the Westside Club for a noon meeting. Before I ever went home to see my animals, I was at the Westside Club. I was back for the 5:30, and I was back for the 8 o'clock. I called in my work again. They knew I'd been in the hospital. They knew I was out. I called in for the next week and said, I really need a little extra time. And I was at every single meeting that they had at that club for that whole week. When I started back to work, I was making the noon meeting and then going to work because I was a waitress. And I served liquor. I served alcohol. And you know what? When I made that first admission that I was powerless over alcohol, I took the power out of alcohol. I could go to work and serve that liquor. I'm not going to say that sometimes it didn't smell good or anything like that, but I'm also going to say that I really did not want to drink it. Now, the people that I worked with were also the people I drank with. So they would keep asking me out. You know, come on, where are we going to go with the, you know, when we get out of here? You know, when you get off from work at that time of night, there's nothing else open but the bars. And the bars held almost as much hold on me as the liquor itself. So my sponsor, I got a sponsor. She was working third shift at the hospital on the telephone. So I could call her anytime, all night long. I didn't have a problem. So she insisted, this was before I ever got a cell phone, and she insisted I call her when I got off from work. So when they would ask me to go out, I would say, y'all go ahead, I'll meet you there. In my head, I'm planning on running home. I'll call my sponsor, And I'll tell her everything's okay, and I can run back up and have a Coke for last call. You know, I would go home and call my sponsor, and I'd never go back out. Once I got home, I would be in. I'd be on the phone with her 2 or 3 times all night, you know. And this continued until they quit asking me at work. And I started working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The first step worked me when I truly understood that I was powerless over alcohol, that my life was totally unmanageable. Nobody else has a life that's manageable. It, you know, if I have $650 rent and I have $550 to pay it and I'm short $100, I don't go spend $100 at night at the bar and think that's manageable just because I don't have it all. You know, but I did that on a regular basis, and I found that that was not manageable. So we started working those steps, and I got to step 2. You know, first I had to know that I was insane, which I really didn't think I was insane. And then I hit that part in the big book. She had me reading in the big book, and I found out that it tells me in the big book that in a lot of ways in our life, we are sane. But when it comes to drinking, when it comes to alcohol, we are totally insane in the way we do that. And I agreed with that. I could accept that at that point. I've learned since then that I'm insane in a lot of other ways, too. But that was what my drinking was. In step 3, I had to turn my will and my life over to the care of a God that I had no clue what he was. He didn't like me. If he didn't like me, he wouldn't let me be an alcoholic. If he liked me, I wouldn't have the problems I had. But she explained to me that when I have to turn my will and my life, that's my thoughts and my actions. If I turn my thoughts and my actions over to something good, good things are going to happen. And that was the way I had to go with that first God. You know, the group of drunks from Alcoholics Anonymous, good orderly direction. I used all of that because I couldn't believe that there was a God in my life that was going to do anything for me. But I believe the people in Alcoholics Anonymous would because they already had. They already had. They took care of my animals. They took care of me when they first came in. They truly did. They actually talked to me. They wanted to be around me. I went ahead and did that 4th and 5th step that they talk about. And I found out that if it's ever been done before, it's already got a name. If it's got a name, somebody else has already done it bigger and better than I ever could or did. I found out that by telling somebody else about it, I took that weight off of my shoulders. That didn't mean that anything had changed other than the fact that I shared it with somebody else and I recognized it for what it was. When I went into 6 and 7, that was when I started going into the spirituality steps. I had to talk to that God of my understanding. You know, even if he didn't know me, I had to turn around and tell him that I'd be willing to let him take over. That was hard. That was hard. Because, you know, I was too used to running the show on my own. I was too used to making my own decisions instead of stopping and saying, give me strength, give me guidance, give me hope. You know, I didn't want to ask anybody for anything, but I had to do that. And I did it just a little bit at a time. You know, I didn't do it all at once. I didn't do it all perfect, but I did it to the best of my ability at that time. And it might not have been a lot of ability, but it was the best of my ability at that time. So I did do 8. I made that list of all the people I had harmed that I could remember at that time. I remembered later that there's other people I had to keep adding to it. Because you don't remember 33 years in 2 months. You know, it just don't happen. But I did that, and I started making those amends on that list. And this is 10 years later, and I'm still making those amends. I have to hold myself ready. There are some people on that list that have passed away. And when I do that, there's another type of amends. I do a living amends. I was taught that I could never go and say I'm sorry because I've been sorry all my life, and nothing ever changed. So they all knew I was sorry anyways, what I was told. You know, so I have to go to them, and I have to say, you know, I know that my actions have affected you. I know that I need to set the record straight between us, so I need you to tell me what I can do to set things right. And then I have to take action on it. I have to do what they tell me that I need to do. You know, that's what it's about. It's not about going and saying you're sorry. It's about taking action to correct the wrongs that you have done. That's what they told me. And so I had to correct the wrongs that I had done. And I've done a lot of them, and I'm still working on a lot of them. And that's what I did. So when I got to step 10, sought through prayer and meditation, man, that was hard for me because I couldn't sit still and get my head clear. You know, I would do good to get 10 seconds at a time of not having any thoughts in my head to wait. You know, and they tell me that prayer and meditation, prayer is me talking to a God and meditation is me waiting for an answer. Now, I'm really good at talking, but I wasn't good at waiting. And I still have problems with that today. You know, but that's where I'm at. Now, step 12, it says having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And I can tell you this on my part, from my experience, after I got through all 12 steps, I had that spiritual awakening. I had that conscious contact with the God of my understanding. It might not be the God that you understand, and that's okay. It doesn't matter. I understand what I'm supposed to understand through working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. One thing I do want to say is that since I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous, I jumped right into service. My sponsor turned out to be a service freak. And the people here that know my sponsor know I'm telling the truth. So from day one, I was following her around doing service. So by doing that, I also got into service. And when I had enough time, I was the GSR for my home group. I was involved in my home group. I was involved in intergroup. I was involved in district. And those of you that are new and don't understand, this is the service structure, because even though Alcoholics Anonymous is a free organization, we all get together to help each other, and it's a bunch of drunks trying to help drunks, we still have to have some sort of way to know that the doors are going to stay open to help the ones that are still looking for help. And that's what the service structure is. And I've been involved in that service structure all the way up to North Florida. I've been involved up to North Florida for the past 8.5 years of my sobriety. And I don't say that to tell you what a good job I've done or anything like that. I tell you that because I want to tell you how grateful I am that Alcoholics Anonymous allowed me to learn how to be sober to be able to do that. Now, one of the rewards that has come about from doing that is exactly what it says. Those promises that were read at the beginning of the meeting have come true for me. You know, I've gone through cancer 3 times. I never used to talk about this when I spoke because I figured it didn't involve Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had a friend of mine with a lot of years tell me that, yes, it did. It very well did involve Alcoholics Anonymous, because if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't be sitting here alive today. And anything that keeps me alive through Alcoholics Anonymous, I need to share. In 2000, I was diagnosed with a female cancer. I had surgery, and I was out of work for 4 months. They checked my lymph nodes, and thank God they got it all, and I never had to go through chemo or radiation. In 2003, I developed a face cancer, a skin cancer, and it had gone on for a long time because I didn't do the things that was taught to me, which is take care of me physically. I didn't go get those medical checkups that I needed to get up until that point. Then I started taking, and listening, when I went to get the medical checkups, I found out that I had basal cell carcinoma. It had gone for a long time. When they tried to take it out with molar surgery, it was so deep, they wound up taking about half my face. And then they had to go back in with plastic surgery. And I had, was it 9 or 10 surgeries all told? They know better than I do because I was unconscious a lot of the time. They know. Anyway, what happened was after I had that surgery, I wound up with, I had an allergic reaction to antibiotics, and I wound up in the hospital for a month, loaded out with bacterial colitis. And they called my father down, and called my kids in to come and say goodbye to me because they didn't think I was going to make it. And you know what? I have a God in my life today. And there's a lot of people that actually learned that I was an okay person when I sobered up. And these people were praying for me, and I was praying. And yeah, my prayer wasn't so much to live. My prayer was so much to do what I needed to do. And I came through it, and I got out of there. Now, the whole time my face was open and everything, I still continued meetings. And I heard one girl say, "Oh, you're so brave because you did that." No, I wasn't brave. I was scared to death. If I hadn't been scared to death, I wouldn't have my butt in the meeting the way I looked. That's just a fact of it, because my face was just completely raw me. And I knew that in order for me to get through this, and me not drink, and me keep going, I had to be in a meeting. Well, that was in 2003. Then in 2005, I was diagnosed with liver cancer. They said on this liver cancer that I had about 3 months to live. They said that the tumor was too big for me to be eligible for a transplant. Mark and I sat up there with the doctor twice when the doctor told me that I would not get a transplant. That according to Florida law, when the tumor's over a certain amount, you're not eligible. I came back. I did all the things I was supposed to do. I went and got on Social Security. They gave it to me immediately because I had a paper stating that I was going to die, that it would be in my system in 3 months and I wouldn't make it. I was okay. They couldn't understand how I could sit there and laugh while I was getting this stuff. But I was okay emotionally. After that first bout, I came home, kicked, screamed, beat the walls and everything else. And then it dawned on me, God didn't do this to me. I did. The choices I made, the liquor I drank, the drugs I did, caused this cancer from stage 4 cirrhosis. And it went into cancer. And I was 8 years sober. It's like, why me? I've been sober 8 years. Why me? Yeah. And it dawned on me, it's because of what I did. It's exactly because of what I did. So from that point on out, it was like, okay, I'll do what I have to do. And my biggest prayer at that point in time was, God, give me the strength to do your will. To know that the glory goes to you and not to me. And give me the courage to do this with grace. And that was my prayer. Well, when I got on the waiting list, they called me back and said, we're going to put you on that list. These doctors have decided that they're going to put you on that list. Every time they told me no, they call me back for more testing. And I would go back for more testing, and they tell me no again, and they call me back up there again. And they finally put me on that list. And I'm sitting here today, and I'm telling you the absolute truth. The only thing that happened was that God got behind some of their consciences and pushed them. So they decided they'd go ahead and do that. And they went against Florida state law to put me on that list because the tumor was too big. And they also told me not to expect too much because it takes about a year to wait for a liver. I had about 3 months. 7 weeks later, we got the phone call. I got the liver, January 5th, 2006. Now, the only reason I'm sitting here alive today is because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the God that I learned in these rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. So there's miracles around here. I'm not the only one. There's one. I see miracles. Every time I look around here, I see the miracles that's working in this program. That's why I keep coming back and I make the meetings I do, because I need to keep seeing these miracles. I do not want to forget for one moment that there's a God in my life. Alcoholics Anonymous gives me the way, the truth, and the path to go, because this is definitely a way of life. It's not just a matter of doing steps or anything else. It's a way of life. And I love this life today. And I think I'll keep coming back. Thank you.